You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Wednesday, 8 July. We've got FOMC minutes to 8 p.m. this evening. This, of course, the first FOMC with the new chair. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Ken Nyana from Prime XBT. In a world awash with oil, and that scares Woods, and he's been spot on around that, is there still an energy trade out there? And where is he looking for value in the US outside of tech, if there is perhaps some value there? Craig Stewart, Ultron Digital Business. They've got a new index out, which is measuring employee experience of technology, the gap between what they need and what they have at work. And then we're going to chat crypto, SARS and the new tax guide, and a lot of grey areas to look out for. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb: Pick and Pay wants to give CEO more shares to achieve turnaround. Roughly 25 million in shares will be awarded in August, which offsets those forfeited by the delay of achieving break-even, and of course offsets the whole purpose of the benefit shares. Business Day, Treasury freezes funds for 69 municipalities over financial failures. This includes Johannesburg and Buffalo City. Morning markets, US was red, S&P down 0.5%, NASDAQ 1.75% lower, and the 10-year looking nasty, 4.550%. The East is mixed. We got Sydney off 0.25%, Tokyo down 0.75%, Hong Kong up 2.5%, and Tencent up 3%. Commodities mostly green. The red is gold futures, 4,139. Everything else green. Brent 7608. Platinum 1,649. Palladium 1,272. The rand is 1626. Bitcoin 62,900. Top 40 opening call, a red open, but 67 points or 0.06% lower.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Ken Nyana from Prime XBT. Ken, appreciate the early morning time. Before the American invasion of Iran, whenever I asked you around Sasol, asked you around oil, your answer was the world is awash with oil. And I got to say, Straits of Hormuz and 20% of the global oil being taken out of supply, and oil only got to 120, shows perhaps just how much it was awash with oil. My question is there still an energy trade in this environment? And you know, maybe it's a, you know, maybe it's coal, maybe it's uranium, maybe it's a case of oil is the key one and there's just too much of it. Is there an energy trade still in the market?
I think there probably is an energy trade. I mean, this all predicates that there's not going to be any geopolitical risk, because I mean, over the past 24 hours, it seems like the Iranians and the US are still launching projectiles at each other and just not agreeing as to how to coordinate the Strait of Hormuz. But I think over time, Sire, what I was truly looking out for is not to really just buy the broad sector in energy, but to just look over the cost curve and see actually who has this fortress play. And I think there's a big oil companies in the US, the likes of Chevron, ExxonMobil, Total Energies, also still listed on the New York Stock Exchange, who on the cost curve, even if oil remains at about $70 a barrel or slightly lower, they're producing per barrel close to about $40. So that still gives you a margin of safety. So if you really say, is the energy trade still on? I'd say yes. I think just look for more efficient, low-cost operators.
I get your point. I mean, as you said, at 70, there's still folks who are producing way below. And even if oil were to sink lower, I don't know, get into the 60s, they're still making a big truck of money at current prices. So shifting on completely, in the US, the story's all around tech. But of course, you know, I mean, tech is the dominant story, but not necessarily the dominant sector. There are thousands of other stocks. Where are you looking for value or opportunity outside of tech in US markets?
I think over the past few days, the big American banks, the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, as well as you look at Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, have released the H2 predictions on the S&P 500. And if you look through some of those reports, I mean, they would say that past the mega cap AI trade, where multiples are incredibly stretched, the rest of the market is quietly building fundamentally sound earnings. And I think if you look at U.S. financials, the yield curve and credit play, you look at global infrastructure as well, these are really, really selectively defensive sectors right now. And if we can look for specific tickers on these, I mean, JP Morgan Chase as a bank, fortress-like balance sheet, as Jamie Dimon speaks of his company, Morgan Stanley, a brilliant wealth manager. Siemens is one I like. It does trade in Frankfurt and as an ADR on the US. But I mean, Siemens is really quite a bellwether in terms of industrial play. But there's many who have pricing power and have been able to just build great solid earnings over a period of time that I think are going to be the sectoral rotation play from this AI mega cap trade.
Gotcha. And it is, I mean, that pricing power. And I mean, some of these names you mentioned there, they've got proper pricing power. Absolutely have. We'll leave it there. Kenyana Prime XBT, always appreciate the early morning time. The Standard Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Craig Stewart. He's Altron Digital Business Managing Director. Craig, appreciate the time. The Employee Technology Experience Index from Altron out today. Talk us through, before we get into some of the details, what is this index? What is the methodology? What you're looking to achieve?
Thanks for having me, Simon. The Altron Financial Services Industry Employee Experience Index report set out to really answer three core questions, being firstly, how does technology experience shape employee experience? What is the impact on business outcomes? And then finally, you know, where would one's investment have the greatest impact?
I like that. So you're not measuring uptime, you're measuring frustration in a sense, and you're trying to put a rand value to that frustration.
Absolutely.
And I mean, do you succeed? What is the cost to tech-related disruption? I want to delve into what some of it isn't in a moment, but I'm fascinated if we can put a rand value to it.
So we found that in the research that technology friction is effectively a hidden productivity tax that never really shows up on any dashboard. Mm-hmm. We estimate that it costs between 3.2 million rand to 30 million rand per 1,000 employees a year. And nearly half of those employees say that that friction has already reached their customers. And, you know, we believe that that's a real number hiding inside, you know, every financial services company cost base.
And I mean, at 30 million per 100, I know a couple of 50, 60, 100,000 companies out there, those numbers get absolutely humongous. And is this as simple as maybe it takes my laptop 20 minutes to boot up, or maybe I'm running a Windows XP or something like that? I mean, is it perhaps as simple and as prosaic as that in some places?
It can be as simple as that. Mm-hmm. And what we found quite interestingly is there is apathy in the data. So in the research that we got back, around 30% of employees are actually no longer raising their technology issues because they believe that nothing changes.
And that then becomes, I mean, this is not just a dissatisfied or frustrated employee. I mean, this could become a governance. This could become a compliance issue more than just a frustration issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, we're not here. This is not an anti-tech. I mean, this is, tech is huge. Take away the technology that sits on my desk right now, I would be unable to do my business. This is not saying we don't like tech. This is just saying we need it perhaps in many cases to be at a better level, a higher standard.
Absolutely. What we found was that, you know, it's more important to actually diagnose where the biggest issue is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it depends on the goal. What we're not saying here is go and invest more money in your technology estate. The important aspect here is to diagnose before you prescribe. So if the goal here is employee advocacy and retention, what the research finds is that IT support is the sharpest lever. It was the strongest predictor of 10 of 13 positive outcomes that we measured. Mm-hmm. If it's future readiness and motivation, AI enablement becomes really, really important. if it's protecting the customer experience, it's the core network, it's core applications, because those are the strongest predictors of where the friction reaches the end customer, even though, you know, those things won't lift employee sentiment on their own.
I want to touch on a couple of things you said. The one is the point that you make is, and you made this up front as well, which is this has reached the customer already. A lot of it's going to be the individual frustration. A lot of it will be colleague to colleague frustration, but a lot of this ends up at the customer space as well, which is, you know, that's your front line.
Absolutely. And I think those are the numbers that are not being measured. So obviously, you know, we've managed, and through the methodology that we used, salary is a proxy for productivity. So employees know their own salary, and it reflects what the business is investing in that particular person. You know, we measured how often and how long people are disrupted, and then we map that against respective salary bands. So it's a range, not a point estimate. Mm-hmm. And importantly, what we found was the median is actually far lower than the mean. And, you know, that's because the cost is concentrated in a small group of heavily disrupted and often higher earning employees. Yeah. Now, the next phase of this is obviously to put a value on the customer impact, which is obviously not a cost that we measured in this particular research.
Gotcha. But which to the corporate, in many cases, will be a direct cost, which they feel. You mentioned AI. Two questions around it. Is there, and I don't know if you asked the questions around this, is there a lot of take up of using AI, different tools of AI? And is it sort of helping the situation or perhaps hindering it?
Absolutely. So we found that AI adoption in financial services companies is not the problem. Mm-hmm. 85% of respondents have access to AI tools. Mm-hmm. They're using AI on a weekly basis, and they're genuinely reporting that their AI tools are useful. However, only 20% of respondents feel that their employer is preparing them for an AI-enabled future. Only 35% of respondents agree that their institution systems are AI ready. And then more concerning is around about 30% of respondents primarily rely on AI tools that they've sourced themselves, which obviously becomes a governance and risk compliance issue.
Yeah, we're back to that risk issue, which perhaps is in some ways the biggest part of it, but I'm still 30 million per 1,000 employees. Man, there are banks out there with 50,000 employees. Run the numbers. We'll leave it there. It's Craig Stewart. He's Managing Director, Ultron Digital Business. Appreciate the time. And that's our poll today. LinkedIn, how's your work tech? Is it up to scratch? Are you running on old computers and Windows XP, or have you got the latest, fanciest, I don't know, MacBook M something, whatever it might be? Have your vote. Have your say. LinkedIn. Let your money benefit from experience with StanLib Asset Management. Find out about StanLib Global Select Fund, which follows an investment discipline that has delivered results for three decades.
MoneyWeb now. On the money.
Chatting now with Dr. Vian Olufier. He's partner and global co-head of digital assets at Faraz Mazars. Vian, appreciate the time as always. SARS has published its draft guide to the taxation of crypto assets. I think the industry taxpayer has been waiting a while for this. It seems to answer many questions, but perhaps also leave a lot of questions unanswered and some grey areas. I'm thinking, for example, you know, the difference between income or capital gains. SARS says there's case law, which is, frankly, a little bit messy.
Simon, good to speak to you again this morning. Yeah, so the draft was released now earlier this week, and to be brutally honest, I think this is several years too late. I mean, the specific tax transactions that they're referring to in the draft has been around for whiles now. And I mean, if you take a step back, initially they merely said that the normal rules apply. And now we are years later, they are explaining basically simple type of transactions, and the asset class has significantly evolved, and the transactions that taxpayers engaged with are much more complex than those included in the draft. So it does raise the question, is the benefit that the draft really gives to us at this point in stage. I mean, there are talks about clarity in terms of, yes, cryptocurrency can be seen as capital, but once again, it's based on a variety of circumstances that would form an opinion on whether it would be capital income in nature. So it doesn't help a lot of taxpayers a lot, because because they have been engaging with these types of transactions and have been engaging with reputable financial advisors or tax advisors, rather. So I'm not sure what benefit it gives to the taxpayers at this point in stage.
And some of it, I mean, in the recent note you put out, you talk, for example, swapping one crypto to another. So if I go from Bitcoin to Ethereum, I didn't even go through ZAR. I go direct from crypto to crypto. Tax event. Okay. But there's a lot else. And it's your point around the way that the industry has changed, staking, DeFi, there's so many more nuances in this industry. And truthfully, it's still changing. It's not yet perhaps all settled either.
You're 100% right, and that's why the draft focuses on first-generation tax question and doesn't cover topics such as wrapped assets, such as crypto-backed lending. And to complicate it even further, SARS explicitly says in the draft that cryptocurrency is not equity, but now we're moving in a world where we have tokenized shares. So so where does this all come into play? That's why I'm saying this draft that came out is already outdated based on what we're seeing in the market. So I'm not sure what the idea was in terms of waiting this long period to actually release it. But I think at this point in stage, if we look at the current tax issues that taxpayers engage with on a regular basis these days, how long are we going to wait for explicit guidance on those type of transactions? Will it only be 10 years from now that we're going to have an idea of what is wrapped assets going to look like? What is crypto-backed lending and collateralized loans going to be like? So that is a concern. And I've always said that with tax, you can catch more flies with honey. And that's why we need this this authoritative guidance to provide the taxpayers with an idea of exactly the tax treatment when they enter into a specific transaction.
So where does this leave taxpayers? Because you make a point as well, is that if anything, enforcement is increasing. It's not decreasing. And we get that. I mean, this is what tax authorities the world over are doing. It kind of leaves the taxpayer and their tax experts to sort of make up their own mind as to how to treat events.
Yeah, so that is the difficult part, because one thing what we saw, and not in South Africa, we see this on a global basis. If there isn't proper guidance, people omit to include cryptocurrency in their tax returns. And of course, there are some difficulty in ensuring the completeness of the taxpayer's revenue from a cryptocurrency perspective. But with the new CARF framework that was implemented by various of the OECD countries, various countries will start to share cryptocurrency transactions. And of course, SARS are sharpening their tools in terms of catching taxpayers that haven't been declaring their income either from local exchanges or foreign exchanges. And the OECD, or rather the CARF framework, would effectively allow them to catch more taxpayers that have been omitting to include their information, or rather their gains from their cryptocurrency activities within their tax returns. And I mean, there is difficulty. I mean, there's a lot of products out there. I mean, one of the new products that's been rolled out now is CoinFig, that allows South African taxpayers actually to link with this platform, to link to the various cryptocurrency exchanges, both locally and abroad, to calculate the tax liability based on the South African tax rules.
And this is impacting, I mean, one of the numbers that absolutely jumped out at me, roughly 6 million South Africans hold crypto. Now, some, like me, I'm a hodler. I can't even remember how long ago it was I bought my Bitcoin and I hold it. But that is a big number of people.
Yeah, that's a big number of people. And I'm very curious in terms of how many of them have been declaring their taxes, completely declaring the taxes, and the accuracy of the declaration of those taxes as well. And I mean, that figure continues to grow as we see this reflexiveness of digital asset in the market, either from a utility point of view or from a speculative point of view. More and more people are engaging with the asset class. So it needs to move in the direction where we see this global adoption. And therefore, the taxpayers and regulators need to move along the same lines as well, to make sure that they get their piece of the pie at the end of the day. But to do that, they need to provide authoritative guidance and stay on the ball. We can't be lagging when it comes to regulations or tax guidance.
Yeah, 100%. Anyway, so there is a comment is open, public comment until 31 August on their draft guide to taxation of crypto assets. Everyone go and have their say. We'll leave it there. Appreciate the early morning time. That's Dr. Vian Olofeer. He is partner and global co-head digital assets for Roz Mazars. That's it for today. We're chatting with Jimmy Muyaha yesterday, talking around clicks. On a simple PE measure, it is cheaper than it has been any point in the last 15 years. The dividend yield is the highest it's been in 15 years. We asked if this is a good time to be buying. Over half said yes, great value. Almost a third said no, shoppers are changing their habits. The rest said you preferred others. Mostly, I suspect, Dis-Chem, and Jimmy did make that point. It's a Clicks or Dis-Chem debate. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchli, Nicole, Sabu, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Massive short positions in some of the retail stocks.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.